U.S. economic growth slows to a crawl.
And the debt ceiling drama rages on.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Friday, July 30th.
Coming up, GDP growth slows to 1.3% in the second quarter.
And is Congress just procrastinating? We ask the experts.
Later, food trucks start putting down roots. That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
GDP inched up 1.3% in the second quarter. Gross domestic product measures all the goods and services our country produces. It's one of the most watched economic indicators. Chris Lowe is chief economist for FTN Financial. He joins us live. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Stacey.
So tell us, Chris, why was economic growth so disappointing?
Well, the big thing is that consumer spending was really weak in the quarter. It rose just 0.1%, which is actually, it's even worse than that. If you peel back the covers a little bit, consumption fell in every month of the quarter. And the reason, primarily higher gas prices, but also car sales after the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. There were shortages of cars and they fell.
What about the debt ceiling debate? How is that factoring into this?
Well, I think one of the things they need to be thinking about in Washington as we move forward is that it's not just a government shutdown that's a possibility if they can't reach a deal. It's also the economy that's at risk. When you have barely got any growth at all, any significant blow to consumer confidence could tip us over the edge.
Any good news here?
Yeah, I think that the one thing we can all hang on to is that the earliest leading indicators, particularly jobless claims, which measures layoffs, have improved in the beginning of the third quarter. It does look like the economy is going to reaccelerate, again, as long as they don't mess things up in Washington.
Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The GDP could come into play on Capitol Hill, where leaders have rescheduled a vote to today to cut the federal deficit while raising the nation's debt ceiling. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch. She joins us every Friday, and she's with us now from New York with the latest. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Let's forget the politics, and I want to get to the debt ceiling debate going on in Washington. This plan versus that plan, because both plans cut spending and raise the debt ceiling. The GDP report is really disappointing. What would either one of them do, those plans, do to an already fragile economy?
Let's be clear. When the government spends less, it has a negative impact on the economy. The bigger the short-term cuts, the lower the GDP. The reduction in all government spending this year alone has shaved a little more than 1% off total growth.
These plans, Jill, don't include tax increases, right?
Nope.
So they're a down payment, I would imagine, on getting the U.S. fiscal house in order. Wouldn't that encourage private sector growth?
The evidence is murky from the consumer point of view. If taxes are at these levels, they get extra money, they're going to pay down debt. We just learned that consumer spending in the second quarter was the weakest it's been in 2 years, so companies aren't seeing enough demand for goods and services to justify new hiring. I think we're stuck here, Steve.
We're stuck. All right. Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Thank you.
By the way, if you're looking for more details on the numbers, you can check out our website, marketplace.org. Well, the cloud of economic uncertainty spawned by the debt ceiling debate is spreading to states now. Places like Maryland, which was recently told its AAA credit rating might be downgraded. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Any of you have a big brother? Remember what it was like to be blamed for something he did? Nancy Kopp knows how that feels.
Well, yeah. It is pretty annoying.
Kopp is the treasurer of Maryland. Her big brother, the federal government. The credit rating agency Moody's told Kopp that Maryland might be downgraded because its economy is so dependent on federal spending. State income taxes come from the Maryland residents who work for the feds. Many Maryland companies rely on government contracts. Warren Deschanel is the state legislature's chief budget analyst. He says a downgrade would lead to higher borrowing costs.
So it would be another $1 million or so per $100 million of borrowing.
Treasurer Kopp says there's not much the state can do to prepare for a downgrade. She is building up Maryland's piggy bank with enough cash on hand to pay the bills for several months with no new borrowing. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
States might be planning ahead, but Congress still seems deadlocked. That's cutting it pretty darn close to the Tuesday default deadline, which is a pretty familiar feeling for many of us. Cable bills, term papers, taxes. You procrastinator at all, Steve?
I'm a procrastinator, yes. If I really don't want to do something, I wait and wait until the very last minute.
Yeah, I am exactly the same way. I don't think I have filed my taxes before the day I absolutely have to file them ever in my life. Well, the only times when I have actually filed for an extension. Anyway, Timothy Pitchell studies why we put things off at Carleton University. Good morning, Timothy.
It's my pleasure.
So as an expert in procrastination, what do you think of what's going on with the debt ceiling in Washington? Is this the same thing that used to go on when I would be putting off term papers in college?
I've been watching the discussion with a lot of interest because the term procrastination has been used a lot. And President Obama said that his girls get their work done a day early and kind of insinuated that what's going on in the House is procrastination in Congress. But I don't believe that it fits the definition of procrastination at all.
So what is going on and how is it different than procrastination?
Procrastination is always delay, but not all delay is procrastination. And in this case, what we have is people using delay strategically to make political points.
Both sides have said that we can't default on our debts. So is this potentially procrastination in that way or
doing something at the last minute when you plan on doing it at the last minute is not procrastination. But we like to think of procrastination as weakness of will. We know what the right thing to do is, but we delay doing it. And in this case, the debate is, so what's the right thing to do? And if I see any procrastination in this issue at all, it's not with the government right now, but it's the self-regulation failure we've seen that brought this debt crisis, right? Because procrastination is just one form of self-regulation failure. And the self-regulation failure here has always been to have more than I could actually afford.
Can this kind of delay ever be a productive thing in a negotiation? Is there ever anything good about a delay or about procrastinating?
There's lots of things good about delay. You know, we use delay all the time. Every day you and I will delay things in our lives as we strategize and optimize our schedules and prioritize. Procrastination is that one form of delay that is negative by definition. Delay has lots of use in negotiations like this. Procrastination doesn't. And I think we're all yelling, you're procrastinating because we can't stand the stress.
Timothy Pitchell is with the Department of Psychology at Carleton University in Ottawa. Timothy, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Well, one of the countries watching the debt debacle very, very closely is China. China owns nearly $1.2 trillion of U.S. debt, and its state-run news agency today said the U.S. is being, quote, kidnapped by dangerously irresponsible politics. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz now explains, despite its concerns about a possible U.S. default, China can't just stop investing in the American economy.
China's the largest foreign holder of U.S. debt, and this is how it works. It buys debt through the purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds, and despite the doomsday worries in Washington, China has no plans to stop. The reason, says Tsinghua University economist Michael Pettis, can be boiled down to its currency, the renminbi.
They're buying foreign assets in order to keep down the price of the renminbi, and by keeping down the price of the renminbi, they ensure that they have a current account surplus.
Current account surplus is economist lingo for trade surplus. In layman's terms, China's huge holdings of U.S. debt help keep its currency artificially low. That, in turn, keeps China's exports really cheap, so cheap that foreigners keep buying them, and that keeps Chinese people employed. This is the formula China's economy has been based on for three decades, and Pettis says China's trapped. The country is now a full-fledged U.S. Treasury bond addict. If it wanted to kick its addiction, Pettis says, it would have to find another currency that would be able to soak up a huge amount of China's money. The only one out there is the euro. But look at Greece, Portugal, and Spain. They don't look stable either. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Well, a rather sobering piece of news really puts things into context this morning, Stacey. Turns out the computer giant Apple has more money than the U.S. government.
No way.
According
is that
to the
true?
Treasury, it is. The U.S.
so
now
depressing.
Has an operating budget of about $73 billion. Apple, on the other hand, has a cash reserve of more than $75 billion. So maybe we need a genius bar on Capitol Hill. I don't know. It couldn't hurt.
I second that motion, Steve. I really do. It couldn't hurt. And maybe that could help us with the debt ceiling. Speaking of which, why do we even have a debt ceiling? We actually put that question to our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. She's here to help us answer that. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Stacey.
Heidi, this is causing a lot of grief. Remind us again, why do we need a debt ceiling?
A lot of people are wondering that. You're not alone. It's really strange. All year, Congress decides to spend this money on this or that. It's like the way you might spend a day shopping at different stores. Not then at the end of the year, the Treasury goes to Congress with the bill totaling everything up the way that you get a credit card bill. Then Treasury has to ask Congress to just sign the bill. And Congress says, oh no, we've spent too much. We can't possibly hand over all that money. But meanwhile, Congress spent the money already. So the approval should just be a formality, and it never is. I talked to Tony Fratto. He's a former Treasury official. He had to ask Congress to raise the debt ceiling 7 times. He said all 7 were pretty high on the ridiculousness scale.
There is no point to the debt ceiling. It is really pointless. I always thought it was the most bizarre thing. This was like in the Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone. Well, Heidi, I've heard that the president could potentially just bypass Congress and raise the debt ceiling by himself. Is that possible? Can he do that?
Oh, Stacey, if only it were that easy. The stakes are higher now. We need to raise the debt ceiling, yes, so we can pay people. But all this fuss has also highlighted what a terrible credit risk we are as a country. We borrow way too much. We make way too little. And Standard & Poor's said they'll downgrade us if we don't come up with a long-term plan to pay off the debt.
Hmm. Heidi Moore here in New York. Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you, Stacey.
Well, with all the debt ceiling drama going on here in the U.S., we figured we'd take you somewhere else for a moment where debt is starting to creep into the national economic psyche. But it's not Greece. It's not Ireland or Portugal. It's Egypt. 6 months after a popular revolution overthrew its dictator, the country's been selling its debt as a way to avert a crisis there. Reporter Julia Simon is with us from Cairo with the latest on that story. Good morning, Julia.
Morning.
So it seems like everyone else is having a debt crisis. Why not Egypt, right?
You know, this whole week, the National Bank of Egypt's been selling domestic treasury bills and bonds, and so far $1 billion worth of T-bills and $500 million worth of T-bonds. And this is the first time since the revolution that the government's been selling bonds. With all the uncertainties, the government's just trying to figure out how to get through the fiscal year.
How bad is the Egyptian debt situation, Julia?
Foreign and domestic debt in Egypt is certainly a growing problem, but the primary concern is the significant budget deficit. Interesting thing, though, is last month they actually turned down a $3 billion loan from the IMF, but they have accepted some money from Gulf countries and from the U.S.
We're hearing of big protests again in central Cairo today. How's the political uncertainty affecting the Egyptian economy?
This week, the finance minister announced that foreign direct investment fell about 75% in the first quarter as compared to last year. And investors worry about the potential devaluation of Egyptian currency. And, you know, with the military in charge and parliamentary elections postponed, everything's very unpredictable here.
Reporter Julia Simon in Cairo. Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
Chevron reported second quarter profits of more than $7.5 billion. All the big oil companies have reported pretty massive profits this week. Still, with oil prices as high as they are, those profits were actually expected to be even higher. As Bob Moon reports, a lack of refinement is what's holding them back.
When it comes to putting enough crude together to actually make gasoline, the big oil companies have to play the market too. Stephen Shork watches the industry at Energy Market Intelligence.
Their refiners have to buy that oil, and they can't necessarily always transfer that high cost of crude oil into the retail market on a consistent basis.
That's because if the cost of gasoline goes too high and we buy less, the refiners can't recoup what they paid for the crude. At the industry consulting group EISA, Sander Cohen says it's a risky business.
What happens is that oftentimes when demand is not very strong is that they get caught in the middle, so they end up being not very profitable.
In recent weeks, several companies, including ConocoPhillips, Marathon, and Murphy, have decided the best way out of that frequent drag on their profits is to either spin off or unload their refining operations.
In separating these two businesses, what they're trying to do is free up capital to pursue what could be more lucrative crude drilling projects.
Analyst Stephen Shork puts it more directly. Oil companies would rather drill for steady profits because they see no letup in demand for crude. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Starbucks reported higher sales last quarter. Affluent Americans, Stacey, are apparently still buying those $4 double mocha lattes.
Who would be spending $4 on a latte?
Probably most of the people here at Marketplace, because I know we're headed to the coffee shop all
the time. I don't buy them every day. I don't buy them every day. Every day, Steve.
I know. A lot of people, though,
Stacey, I don't want to do my taxes.
A lot of people, regardless of income, are also eating, and you've seen these around L.A. when you lived here, and probably in New York as well, food trucks. There's a new business model which has those food truck owners opening up sit-down restaurants. Tracy Samuelson reports.
Three chicken tacos and one chili slider. Okay, your total's $14.
For just under a year now, the popular food truck Mexico has been serving up its blend of Mexican food and Southern barbecue all over New York City, from Midtown one day to Williamsburg, Brooklyn the next.
I think, you know, the truck is the most phenomenal marketing tool in the world. I mean, we could put this thing in the middle of Midtown on 55th and Park or 45th and 6th, and it could be very visible.
Dave Chalace is co-owner of Mexico. He says his bright orange truck has been a great way to test menu ideas and locations. And at $50,000, it costs far less than a full restaurant. But now Mexico is one of a growing number of food trucks across the country opening a brick-and-mortar restaurant. So why put down roots?
There's something that's always going wrong with the trucks. It's a complicated beast, the truck. And I think restaurants are just a more practical way to expand.
You don't have to worry about parking or weather, not to mention a cramped kitchen. David Weber is president of the New York City Food Truck Association. More than half the group's 27 truck owners are opening restaurants.
So I think that really speaks to the idea of the food truck as an incubator, as sort of a gateway to be a more stable part of the New York City culinary community.
So while food trucks are often talked about as a new disruptive business model, for most owners, they're more like a cautious first step. Schnitzel and Things started as a truck in 2009 and recently opened a Midtown restaurant. Here's owner Oleg Voss.
We moved into the restaurant because it was always part of the plan. I mean, we opened up the food truck with the intention of growing.
But that's not to say that food trucks will fade away. Both Schnitzel and Things and Mexico say they'll never give up the truck and the marketing power it packs. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
And finally, a Lake County, Florida inmate found a way to take advantage of a glitch in the lockup's phone system. So inmate accounts, Stacey, are charged for calls, and they're refunded if a call doesn't go through. So you're charged for the call, but if it doesn't go through, you get a refund.
Well, sounds fair.
Yeah, there was this glitch in the phone system, though, at the Lake County Jail, where it was accidentally refunding twice as much money to inmate accounts. So Larry Stone, this inmate...
Little business going on.
He figured this out, and he started placing calls and then hanging up, and doing it over and over and over and over again until his account racked up more than $1,200, enough to post bond and enough to get out of jail. Other inmates then began doing the same thing. They figured it out, and jail officials finally made the connection that, oh, something's gone awry. Stone, by the way, is back in jail.
Oh, you can't punish that kind of entrepreneurial genius. That's amazing.
They did. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.